listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers recorded on the land of the Wurundjeri people.
Hello, I'm Robin Whittaker.
I'm Dorothy Lee.
And this is the episode for the third week of Easter, and we're going to attempt to discuss all four readings, starting with John chapter 21, 1 to 19, Acts 9, 1 to 6, and possibly 7 to 20, Psalm 30 and Revelation 5, 11 to 14. So let's start with the Gospel, Dorothy. We're here in John chapter 21 in the last of the resurrection appearances. Can you just give us a bit of context and tell us what's going on in this scene?
Well, it's a problematical story, and some people think that John 21 was added later, although there's no manuscript evidence for it. It gives the impression of being a first. You know, the disciples are off fishing. You wouldn't think that they'd actually received the Holy Spirit in John 20. So it's a difficult passage. I think that John tries, and I think largely succeeds in integrating it. It may be that it was part of a second edition of the Gospel, if that's not too modern a way of looking at it. So there's a slight awkwardness about it, but John attempts to integrate it and sees it as the third of the gathered disciples meeting with the risen Christ. And this time we jump from Jerusalem to Galilee. John does tend to do a little bit of those sort of geographical leaps without any explanation. But now we have a very small crowd of seven disciples, two of whom are unnamed, and it's about their meeting with the risen Christ and their recognition of him on the beach through the miraculous catch of fish, a story which is familiar to us also from Luke chapter 5.
Mm.
And it then, the rest of the chapter, some of which we have in our lectionary reading, some of which we don't, concerns the roles of Simon Peter and the beloved disciple, the one who's called the disciple whom Jesus loved, who of course is never identified.
Mm.
And it, the Peter part that we have is his rehabilitation.
Yeah. So I think it's so important that we're back in Galilee, and I mean, we have leapt around. We've sort of almost, there is that slight sense of disconnect from being in Jerusalem and the breathing, the Holy Spirit that we've had in the previous weeks. But they're also fishing again, and I feel like you get something a bit similar at the end of Mark's Gospel. I wonder if John's doing something quite clever with taking us almost back to the beginning, because it's a resurrection appearance, but it's also a call story for Peter.
Yes,
or is it a kind of a recall or a commissioning?
Recall is probably better.
Except
it doesn't take us back to the beginning of John's Gospel so much, because there's no story of the fishing.
Yeah, that's true.
So John actually thinks, oh, well, I'll do that here in the resurrection.
Okay. So they're fishing. And, I mean, the big sign is Jesus appears. You know, they have this interaction. It's unclear if they sort of recognize him at first. You have no fish, no, and he tells them what to do.
Yes.
I wonder if this does take us back to the wedding at Cana, where his mother says to the servants, you know, do what he tells you, and he'll do that abundant sign of turning water into fabulous quality wine.
Yes.
And here, if you do what Jesus tells you, you'll again have an abundant catch amazing fish. Is that?
Yeah. I think so. And yeah. I think it's very much that theme of life in abundance. But it's also the third symbol of the church in all the Jesus community in John's Gospel. So you've got the sheepfold in John 10, then you've got the vine and the branches in John 15, and now you've got the net.
Oh.
So all of them, I think, are symbols of the church, the gathered community of disciples. And it's about, of course, mission. It's about the mission of the community of the church.
Mm. So before we get into the Peter-Jesus exchange, is there anything else we should notice if we think of this as a resurrection appearance that's important to bring out, that's particular to John or exegetically interesting?
I think the resurrection narratives in all the Gospels have this motif of recognition.
Mm.
And it qualifies as a recognition story. So at first, as you say, there's no indication of recognition, nothing said, but there's just someone from the shore yelling out at them. and very helpfully saying, "You've caught nothing." You can imagine how they feel. Oh,
yeah, thanks,
tell.
Thanks, dude, for that helpful advice.
Thanks for that helpful comment. We were trying not to notice. But then he does or says something that's familiar, and that leads to recognition. And this time it's the beloved disciple who's always one up on Peter anyway in John's
this gospel, yeah.
He's as good as Peter, only a little bit better.
Yep.
And he's the one who recognises on the basis of the miraculous catch of fish.
Yeah.
But Peter is the one who spontaneously rushes into the water.
Yes, to greet Jesus, which again is consistent with the earlier scene where they run to the tomb and the beloved disciple gets there first.
Yes, but allows Peter to go in.
But allows Peter to go in, and possibly because of the primacy of Peter in the tradition.
Well,
do you think later?
Also, I think the beloved disciple, I'm more and more convinced that the beloved disciple as an historical figure, and I think he was a historical figure, whether he wrote the gospel, of course, is another question.
Mm.
I think he was the source of the gospel, but I think he's outside the 12. So it's and not that John cares too hoots about the 12 particularly, or at least doesn't really. He does mention them, but there's nothing specific about them. But I think that he's another disciple, perhaps a much younger person outside of
The named 12 that came down in tradition.
Hmm. Yes, I think that allows for the precedence that's given to Simon Peter.
Yeah.
But also allows for the fact the community is saying, you know, our guy is really, really as good as Peter, if not even slightly better.
Yes. And, of course, I mean, a bit like other resurrection appearances in the Gospels, there is an emphasis that this is not a ghost, you know, that Jesus, they cook the fish, they eat together.
Yes.
In some ways they're doing a very normal human thing. We get in verse 13, Jesus took the bread and gave it to them. So we've got this, you know, what is clearer in Luke's resurrection, but a kind of breaking of bread
that, absolutely.
Again, I think is supposed to evoke a memory of how Jesus acted. Sorry,
and also possible Eucharistic overtones too.
Yeah,
that Jesus, all the difference between failure and success is quite simply the presence of Jesus. Of course, that redefines what success is and what failure is as well.
Yes.
At the same time. But Jesus not only makes possible mission but also nurtures the community for its mission.
Mm. I like that.
And feeds them with bread and fish with Eucharistic overtones.
In that abundant life kind of way rather than abundance for the sake of abundance. But,
Yes, exactly.
So should we talk about the 15 to 19 section, which is this –
I'm glad you didn't ask me about the 153 fish. Do
we have an answer to that? Okay, let's move along then.
I'm allowing a more mathematically minded person. Some students say to me, maybe that was the number. I said no. I always say no. There's no way. You would say 150. You would not say
153. It's a very odd number, isn't it?
And the ancient world really did love little games with numbers. So whoever's into little games with numbers, just play away.
Play away.
You're
and know that
right.
there's centuries of people trying to puzzle over why that specific number and probably not a great solution on record. So.
One I think that may go back to Jerome, I'm not sure if it is Jerome, but one of the early fathers and mothers of the church says it relates to every single type of fish there is.
Oh, so there were 153 known species of fish or something at that time.
Yeah, that's one theory. And it's an old one and it's not a bad one.
No, that's a – yeah. So make of it what you will. Probably don't write an entire sermon about 153 fish. It's not the point of the story. But let's move on to Simon Peter and these series of three questions.
Yes.
I have lots of questions for you, Dorothy. One is, you know, the fact there's three questions and three answers, is that supposed to, do you think, parallel the three times that Peter denies Jesus?
Yes, it does. It's it's a conversation that Peter finds extremely difficult because of the intensity of the questioning, and it precisely parallels the threefold denial that Peter engages in John 18.
Yep.
And of course, after the third time, the cock crows. Nothing about Peter weeping, of course. That's not in John's gospel, but there is a denial, and this is the only gospel where Peter is explicitly rehabilitated.
in this way.
In this way.
Although, and I think he is in Mark, because there's a little mention, go tell the disciples and Peter.
Yes.
Just to let you know, he's still a disciple, still even in, though he did that. But yes,
we still include him.
This is a much clearer inclusion of Peter with
it's
a key role.
Narrative,
yes,
isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And what about the words for love? I know there's for people who don't read Greek, the question Jesus asks him is, do you love me, using agape? So this big word for love, the agapao. And Peter answers, you know I love you, and he uses the sort of brotherly love term, the phileo. And that gets repeated the second time. And then the third time Jesus says, do you love me? And he uses phileo. He uses Peter's word.
Yes.
Now, back in the day, I remember, you know, that there's this huge difference. I think it's been a little bit debunked that there's such a stark difference between these.
It's been totally debunked.
Okay.
Totally.
So we shouldn't make too much
of the difference. We shouldn't make
anything
of it. Okay. And I'll tell you why. Because John's gospel uses those two words interchangeably. And the whole notion that agape is Christian love is
nonsense.
Not, is nonsense.
Yes.
I'm sure there is such a thing as Christian love. I'm not debating that. But it's not tied to one word.
Yeah.
So despite William Barclay, who should not be read at all, and despite C.S. Lewis, who should be read, but not perhaps on this one.
Not on this. He was not a biblical scholar.
Well, he wasn't, although his book, The Four Loves, is a beautiful study of love. But not tied to words, because John uses phileo and agapao interchangeably elsewhere in the gospel. So it's interchangeable here. And you'll note that it's not just the verbs that are interchangeable. It's also, you know, feed my lambs, tend my sheep. You know, the language for the sheep is also varied. And there's nobody's suggesting there's a difference between shepherding my sheep and tending my lambs.
Exactly. We get the gist of it's the same thing.
It's
being
the good
talked
shepherd
about.
Imagery and it's giving Peter it's not only a rehabilitation of Peter, it's, as you say, it's a call narrative or a recall in which Peter is actually given a role in the church. A role of leadership in the church
and a role
pastoral
lot,
care.
Yeah, and a role a lot like Jesus, when we think that in John's gospel in particular, one of the big images for Jesus is as Lamb of God and as shepherd.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
You know, chapter 10, the good shepherd. So in a sense, it's a big call and a commission to kind of continue the work of Jesus.
Yes, it is indeed.
Yeah.
But it's Jesus' flock. It's his flock. It's not Peter's flock, so that's important, and that then leads into the commission that Peter is given, which is to follow. And Peter has attempted to follow but failed in his following, and now he's called to follow Jesus as pastor, and ultimately, of course, as martyr.
Yeah. So, before we move on, what do you make of those last few verses there about, you know, when you grow old, stretch out your hands, someone else will fasten a belt, take you where you don't want to go.
Yes.
And this reference to Peter's death. I mean, if this is written later, it's possible Peter has already died.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think it's quite likely that Peter has died, and I think it's also likely that the beloved disciple has died as well.
Mm.
So both of these figures are now dead. So we're looking back on them. And of course, the tradition is that Peter died in the persecution under Nero in Rome.
Yeah.
The tradition was that he was crucified, and it could be the language does suggest that.
Mm.
So I think it's referring to that tradition. And if John's written in the 90s, we're looking back something that happened, you know, a generation before.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And yet, despite that cost of discipleship being named there, I do love that the paragraph ends in verse 19 with, and he said to him, follow me.
Yes, that's
like,
right.
Like, this is the call to follow. It's feed my sheep, but it's also to the point of suffering and death.
Yeah, exactly. And it's also, I think, the reason that the questions are so intense, or Peter finds them so intense, is not only because it echoes his threefold denial, but also it emphasises that Jesus is making a big ask of him.
Yeah,
it's a really demanding thing following Jesus. It's the cost of discipleship, you know, as Bonhoeffer speaks of. It's costly to follow Jesus, and particularly for leaders.
Yeah.
Because it's about self-emptying, self-giving love, and that can lead you to death.
Yeah.
It will lead you to death in some way.
In some way, the death of some, yeah.
It's not about power. It's not about status. It's not about anything. It's the opposite.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, perhaps we'll move on to Acts 9, which is another kind of call story, and we can see if there's some themes that link in. So in Acts chapter 9, we have the first of what Dorothy and I are probably going to resist calling a conversion. I don't think it's a conversion. It's an epiphany, this epiphanic experience that Saul has of the risen Christ that's transformative and associated with a call that follows. There'll be three versions of this in Acts, and this is the first. And readers, I mean, we're in a very dramatic section of Acts. There's lots of big things that happen in these couple of chapters. But readers have already met Saul, as he's known still at this point, in chapter 7 in Acts, where he is watching on and holding the coats of those who stone Stephen. And there's a eerie little line in 7:58 where they drag Stephen out to stone him, and they lay their coats at the feet of a young man called Saul. And we're told that Saul approves of their killing him. So Saul is known as someone out to get the Jesus followers. And then we meet him again in Acts 8 as someone who is going about directly seeking to destroy people who follow Jesus, which in this section is going to get referred to as the people of the way.
Yes.
The hodos, the way. So we know him to be a bad guy and to be a threat. And now we get this story, which again starts with still breathing threats and murder. I mean, it's really strong language against the disciples of the Lord. And he does so here with the authority of Jewish leaders, with letters from synagogues in Damascus, so that, you know, he can gather up men and women following Jesus and take them to Jerusalem for, we assume, some kind of tribunal or punishment. So that's the very dramatic, setting going on here. And then, of course, there's light. So, Dorothy, what do you notice in this passage, or what do you think is key?
Well, one of the things I notice is that the authority is coming from the high priest.
Mm-hmm.
So it's from Sadducees. Though Paul speaks of himself in his own writing as a Pharisee, there's no doubt about that he's a Pharisee, but it's the authority of Sadducees, the high priest. It's the priestly establishment that he's following here. It's interesting that although, as you say, this story occurs twice more in Acts, Paul tells it, he doesn't actually tell the story, although people see echoes in 2 Corinthians, but he doesn't actually tell the story in his own letters.
No.
So
no, he refers to an experience he had.
Of glory, yes.
But, yeah, Acts, the author of Acts, gives us far more detail of this account.
Yes.
And there are questions about how historical this is. And, I mean, I think there's a kernel of something happened. You know, there was something dramatic that happened in Saul's life that changed his view from seeing Jesus and Jesus' followers as an absolute threat to Judaism to being key and true to Judaism.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's where the problem with the word conversion is, which the tradition uses. There's nothing wrong with that word in itself, but it suggests someone who's gone from atheism to theism. Mm. And that's not what's happened with Paul. He's actually refocused his devotion to God and to the law, the holy law of God. He's understood that Jesus is now at the centre of it, which he's not understood before. And you get also something of what a passionate character Paul is. You know, he's an all or nothing. He's off or full on, you know.
Yeah.
And there's no in between with Paul. There's no sort of middle way. He's passionate. And he's equally passionate, of course, about his, as you can see in a letter like Philippians.
Yeah. That's
about
right.
His devotion to Christ after this event.
No, I think we can't overemphasize that enough, that, you know, in this in this adopting of Jesus as the Christ, Paul is not rejecting Judaism.
No.
He, in his preaching and teaching in his own letters, he is absolutely clear that this is the same God, the God of Israel,
yes,
that is manifest in Jesus, and will be at pains to point out this is entirely consistent with the way God has actually acted through the Hebrew scriptures.
Yeah, exactly.
So in that sense, conversion implies you've rejected a different worldview, and I don't think that's not what's going on.
It's not the right language. Not these days, not the way we use the word conversion.
No, that's right. I love in this passage, so he sees this bright light. That's typical language for some kind of epiphany, some encounter with the divine, heavenly flashes, and he falls to the ground and he hears this voice from, we assume, the heavenly realm. We're told others hear the voice but don't see what he sees. So for him, it's both an audio and a visual experience.
Yes.
But the question is, you know, why do you persecute me? And he's like, who are you? I'm Jesus who you're persecuting. So the implication being, if you're persecuting Jesus' people, you're persecuting Jesus.
Yes, that's right.
You know, Jesus is at one with his flock, if we want to import a word from John.
Yes. I think it's also interesting that the word persecute, its basic meaning is pursue.
Mm.
And it comes to sort of have perhaps a more technical meaning, but he's pursuing them to Damascus. And yeah. I would actually translate that, why do you pursue me?
Yes.
So in pursuing them, as you say, he's pursuing Jesus himself. And it's interesting that Paul, or Saul as he is at this point, says, who are you, Lord? And that word Lord can, of course, mean sir, but I think it's Lord here. I think he knows who this is. I mean, he's been a witness at Stephen's martyrdom, and Stephen's last words are, Lord, do not hold this sin against them. When he said this, he died. So he has a vision, a heavenly vision himself, and Paul approves of it, but he also witnesses it.
Yes, he does.
So he knows perfectly well who this is that's speaking to him.
Yep. I think that's key. And now, of course, if you're going to preach on this passage, the lectionary gives you the option of just the first six verses, which I find very odd because it just ends with that Jesus quote. But if you keep going and you're going to preach on it, you can keep reading to verse 20.
Or you could even just read to verse 9.
You could.
At least you'd get that first half of the story.
I know, it's a very odd place to stop.
Yeah, it's really odd.
So Saul is affected by this experience. He can't see. And again, when we tell these stories, we need to be so careful that we're not depicting people who are sight impaired as useless or blind, or, you know, conflating physical and spiritual kind of blindness, you know, glibly. But there is a sense that Paul is a bit helpless because this is new to him. He's had a sense that he's relied on removed from him, and there's also a sense of fasting here, whether that's spiritual or he's bereft, or he's so confounded by this experience he doesn't eat or drink either.
It's just what a dramatic experience it is. It's completely overturned his worldview, and his blindness, I think, is perhaps that's not the right way. The fact that he loses sight for a period of time is part of that, the fact that he's just completely discombobulated by this vision that has totally transformed his life.
Yeah.
So it's more an expression of that than of, I don't think it's saying that he's spiritually blind.
No.
It's saying that it's an expression of someone who's received a vision and is overwhelmed by it.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's right.
So I would not speak of it in terms of spiritual blindness at all.
Yep. I agree. And the other thing I find fascinating about this story is this involvement of Ananias. And in this sense, it is actually a story of transformation for more than one person, because Ananias also has a vision and also speaks with Jesus and is told he needs to look out for Saul and lay hands on him and help him regain his sight. And Ananias's initial response is basically, this man is evil.
He's got to be joking.
You've got to be kidding. I mean, so for Ananias, we're seeing here in the early Christian community, I think, an absolute test of what it means to love your enemies.
Yes, exactly.
He's going to get asked to minister to the man who has been doing harm to the community. And it's a reminder to me, too, that God works through and with humans. So, yes, there's been this epiphanic experience, but actually Saul needs other humans to bring him into this Christian community.
Yes.
It's indeed. Not just a private spiritual experience.
No, not at all. And he's baptized, of course.
And he's baptized, yep. And then the sight is restored again. So we probably need to move on, but is there anything else you want to mention about this passage before we do?
No, I think we've covered the main points that I would see in it. I like the image of Christianity as the way. It's a really lovely, I mean, a lot of people relate it to the way, the truth and the life. In John's Gospel, John 14, the I am saying. But I think it's also about way of life. I would not relate it necessarily to John 14, but it's about, it's not, it's, these people are not just pointing to Jesus. They're living a radical life of sharing possessions and caring for the poor and so on. So it's a way of life that they follow, not just follow Jesus in, you know, going around telling people about Jesus. It's also, and primarily, their life, their way of life. So I think it's important to emphasize that with the reference to the way in verse 3.
Yep. And that's a nice segue to Psalm 30, which is all about life. So let's go there next. So we won't say too much about this, but if you want to preach on an Old Testament text during this Easter season, this psalm is perfect because it captures the kind of movement we get over the Easter events, of movement from death into life, the transformation of thing of mourning into joy. We have these wonderful lines here, like in verse 5, that God's anger is but for a moment, but God's favour is for life, or for a lifetime. There's a couple of different ways you can translate that. You might weep at night, but in the morning there is joy. So this sense of, just complete transformation, that life abundantly kind of stuff that we get in John's Gospel in the psalm here.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's also important to emphasise that we do need an Old Testament reading in our readings. I know it's unusual in Acts. The compilers of the lectionary use it as an opportunity to go through Acts, and that's fine, that's good, but I think it's really important we ensure that there is the psalm there, whether it's a response to the Acts reading or it doesn't matter how we do it, but we need to have that. Otherwise we move away from the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, which is the very groundwork for the New Testament.
Yeah, that's so, right.
And I think here you have a sense, yes, a wonderful sense of the transformation from death to life. My NRSV updated edition describes it as thanksgiving for recovery from grave illness. Now that's one way of seeing it, and that's a good way. But the New Testament would also see that it speaks of Jesus because, well, it doesn't speak of Jesus in itself, but that it has that capacity to shed light on Jesus' experience might be a better way of putting it.
Mm.
But you don't really have the hope of resurrection there. It's about restoration. So that what the whole notion of resurrection is a later view. It's not in the, at least in the traditional narrow view of the Old Testament, which doesn't include the books of Maccabees and so on. We don't really have any notion of resurrection except maybe Ezekiel.
Yeah.
So resurrection is kind of added to that. So it's the same God who brings life out of deathly experiences, but now in Jesus there's something definitive here.
Yeah.
That it's death itself has been overcome, and that's the tenor of the psalm, but it points in a way, or for us it does. Jewish readers might read it differently, and of course that's another way of reading it. But we would read it as ultimately pointing to Jesus, I think, and to the joy that comes out of that, all that sadness and sorrow and pain and grief.
Yeah, and for me again, it's really important to read these Old Testament texts alongside the Easter resurrection text.
It's very important
because it points to that this is the same God, and this is consistent with the God who did this. And yes, it's particular and it's slightly different in Jesus, but there has already been this commitment from God as the kind of God who overturns moments of death, who overturns suffering, who wants to restore the people, who wants them to live full and abundant lives.
Yes.
And so whether you use this liturgically or bring it in, I think it's a beautiful psalm to make sure is heard on this Sunday.
And I think it's also worth noting that resurrection is not a Christian invention.
No.
Jewish people, at least many of them, Pharisees in particular, Paul, for example, would have already believed in the resurrection as a Pharisee. So resurrection is not a Christian invention, but it has a specific Christian focus.
Yep. So we better move on to Revelation 5. So the lectionary gives us 11 to 14, which is really just a few verses that give us a glimpse into kind of heavenly worship. They're doxologies, and you could use them liturgically. You could find some hymns that reflect similar language. But I think if you're going to preach on this, you really need to just read the whole chapter. It's not long, verses 1 to 14, because you don't know who's been praised and why if you start in verse 11.
Yes. Yes, that's right. I was going to, and perhaps also even chapter 4 as well.
Yeah.
But, you know, they kind of go together, don't they?
They do.
They seem to. I was going to ask you a couple of questions about that, because we get this recurring theme of the four living creatures and the elders. Can you just enlarge on, on what they actually mean, what they symbolise in Revelation?
So these are, in the previous chapter, we've been introduced to this heavenly kind of throne room where God dwells, and around the throne are angels, and there are these four living creatures who have different animalistic characters and wings, and they're covered in eyes. And I think they broadly symbolise the created order, the different animals and birds of the created order. And they're picking up on Ezekiel. We've met these in other parts of the Bible. Yep. And then the 24 elders, the common interpretation is it's 12 plus 12, so that they represent the 12 tribes of Israel and the 12 apostles.
Yep.
So both Christianity and Judaism, if you want to separate those, which at this stage are probably not two distinct things, but
yes.
Gathered around, and they're clothed in white and they have crowns. So these are kind of almost this language of elders that they're the human element in the heavenly realm amongst all these other strange creatures. I think they represent future resurrected humans and in this kind of symbolic way.
Oh, so they're symbolic for the whole community.
I think so, the whole community of faith. And white, we'll see in this book, is a symbol of resurrected life. If you're next week, we'll get to your clothes being washed white in blood, which is, of course, a complete paradox. And the crowns symbolise victory. So these are people who've remained faithful to God despite hardship and suffering. So they're who worship.
So creation is involved in the worship of God.
Yes. And you'll see this language in verse 15. It's every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and in the sea all sing this song of honour to the throne, the one on the throne and the Lamb, which is God and Jesus. You've got this image here of, you know, the fish in the sea. Like it reminds me of that bit in the Gospels where Jesus said, if I tell them to be silent, even these stones will cry out.
Yes.
This idea that creation itself will worship God even if we humans don't.
Perhaps not the 153 fish in the net.
Perhaps not
those. Who end
those
up on the barbecue.
I don't want to limit God's power in resurrecting the fish so they can worship Jesus. Just saying. But the beautiful image earlier in this chapter is the lamb, who we're told to expect a lion to open this fully sealed up scroll, and there's lots of weeping and drama around. No one's worthy to open it. And then we're told to look for a lion, the Lion of Judah. And when John looks around, he sees a lamb whose throat has been cut. The language here is of being slain or slaughtered, like it's a meat word, it's not sacrificial language.
Yes.
But it's standing. So it's alive.
Still alive.
Yeah. So that is John's image that I think in one line refers to the death and resurrection of Jesus, is the lamb that is slaughtered but standing.
Yes.
Has overcome that death. It's a fantastical lamb. It's got seven horns, seven eyes, so it's all seeing, all powerful.
Yes.
And it's one of the big images for Jesus that I think holds together power and vulnerability or power and self-sacrifice that Jesus is, yes, in this book, incredibly powerful and will come back with power, but is always also the crucified Messiah.
Yes, yes.
And if we forget part of that equation, we're missing.
And that worthy language is associated with worship, isn't it?
Yes.
So it just seems to me here that one of the things that, you know, in everything that you're saying about this is that worship is central in Christian living.
Yes.
I mean, we have people in our church sometimes who imply that mission and evangelism is what we're all on about. And, of course, we are.
Yeah.
But there's a priority, is there not? Would you say to worship? Yep. Do you think that Revelation brings that out?
I think so. And in Revelation, there's a great quote from a scholar called Ruiz that I'm going to paraphrase because I don't have it in front of me, where he talks about worship in the book of Revelation is the kind of launching pad for God's justice. In other words...
That's good, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, it's intrinsically linked to what God is doing in the world, but we can't just be out there doing mission and justice without the worship. They are yes. deeply connected. So God is worshipped for who God is and for what God has done, and it's this ceaseless, ongoing thing in which all creation is bound up. But it is also out of worship in this text, out of this heavenly worship, that the judgments and the justice of God will flow.
Yes.
So, yeah, absolutely. This week and in next week's lectionary, you're going to get scenes of worship that just remind us how important it is to do this.
Yeah, and that would tie in then with John 21 because you've got both worship and mission.
Yes,
in both texts, but a priority given to worship.
Yeah,
and then mission flowing out of that.
Mission flowing out of that, and mission again not as our activity, but our participation in God's activity.
Yeah, that's lovely.
So lots of big themes this week: worship, transformation, call, a chance during the Easter season to revisit one or a few of those things. All the best as you preach. If you'd like to know more about By the Well or any of our hosts, is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College.com and the Uniting Church in Australia. It's produced by Adrian Jackson. Thanks for listening.